Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
The California primary is virtually upon us, more important to the presidential nominating process than it has been for decades. We have three eminently qualified authorities on all things political. Professor Lynn Vavreck at UCLA, Mike Madrid, a Republican strategist and partner in the Grassroots Lab in Sacramento, and Derry Srego in Los Angeles, Democratic political consultant, now also editor and publisher of The Target Book, the last word in nonpartisan analysis of every congressional, state senate, and state assembly district race. Thanks, all of you, for being with us.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks.
Thank you, Warren.
I want to begin with turnout, because that's a factor in every election, and it seems the coronavirus might have a big impact on this one. President Trump insists that it's been contained, but his own federal health authorities are saying it's not a question of if there will be an outbreak, but when. Such a thing is inevitable. Communities are advised to begin preparations. And all this as voters are on their way to the polls. So, Professor Vavreck, let me go to you first. Will there be an impact?
Well, I like that we're leading by saying that one of the differences in this California primary is this virus. And I think that my sense of how it might impact the race is not so much in terms of turnout, but in terms of messaging. And I think it provides an opportunity for candidates to talk about their global approach to things like healthcare, like climate. Some people are better situated to make those connections than others. But I would expect to see most of the difference come in terms of what the candidates are talking about.
Derry Srego, what do you think?
I think that as a practical matter, as Lynn suggested, it's not going to affect turnout very much, because California, in our infinite wisdom, has 30 election days, right? And so it's not as though everybody's got to show up on March 3rd. There'll be a lot of votes cast in environments where exposure to the virus is presumably not much of an issue at all.
Okay, I want to talk about the details of the changes in the process itself. Thanks for bringing that one up. Mike Madrid, what about you? Is the virus going to have an impact, do you think, on Tuesday?
Well, I would agree with the statements that both Lynn and Derry made earlier. I would add one little caveat, and that is we have not had a really high percentage of ballots turned in to this point. It seems like voters, especially Democratic voters, are still kind of trying to figure out who their front runner is, which candidate they may fall in love with, and who they're going to be dedicated enough to show up and vote for. So Derry's exactly right. We have, over the course of the past couple of decades, really started to make voting by mail a little bit more habitual, absentee voting, and fully 60% of some voters in the past have voted by absentee. Because so few are coming in, and because this news is really starting to break, I mean, CDC is essentially saying we meet two of the three criteria for pandemic at this point, and it was presumably going to be pretty fast moving. In the next 7 to 8 days, we're going to learn a lot more about what we should and shouldn't be doing societally, and the question of when people will be mailing their ballots in, because they are waiting for news out of South Carolina at the same time they're trying to figure out whether or not they can show up and vote in person, I think will have some sort of effect on the timing of the voting. I'm hoping it's not going to affect the overall rate, but again, I think we're in a little bit of uncharted territory when it comes to public health at this point. And without sounding alarmist, I think it's something that the CDC is saying could have serious consequences with our everyday life, and voting would be one of those.
We're going to be talking about a lot of the races that are other than the presidential race, but does it really matter as far as the presidential primary is concerned on the Republican side, whether anybody turns out or not?
What I'm looking for is how many Republicans will actually show up as a sign of enthusiasm, and then I'm looking at the percentage that the president gets of those people, those Republicans who show up, to actually say, I'm going to vote for President Trump, or more importantly, I'm not going to vote for President Trump.
Is there time between now and Tuesday for much of a change in the issues that are going to be brought up? And what issues do seem important amongst the various candidates? There are fully 16 of them on the California ballot so far.
It's interesting because oftentimes there's a disconnect between what candidates and their consultants and their staff think they ought to be talking about and what voters care about. And in California, it's usually pretty pronounced. And so, you know, we've got all this talk in some quarters about global warming issues and climate issues, and everybody likes to think that's really important in California because we're at the cutting edge of that from a global perspective. I can tell you from research that I'm seeing, it is just not that salient to California voters. The issues that are salient to California voters at the top of that list right now, and this surprised me when it first happened, and this is going back a number of months, is homelessness. And you know, Trump's talking about it. I don't see a whole lot of discussion of that on the debate stage amongst the Democratic candidates. So I think, and I think Mike alluded to this, look, Californians are not voting in large numbers yet, notwithstanding the predictions of some of our mutual friends in the business. And I think it's because they want to pick a winner, and we just don't know. I mean, you know, after South Carolina, that's all the information we're going to get on that. But I think a lot of voters are sitting on the sidelines, less committed to a particular candidate, although there certainly are those hardcore folks, but simply trying to thread through events to see who's the most likely to be Trump. And I don't think that's affected by the potential pandemic either.
Lynn Vevrick, in The Message Matters, you talked about the need for an insurgent issue for a candidate to challenge an incumbent. If it's not climate change in California, what might it be?
Yeah, great question. So the idea here is that if you're a candidate, especially an incumbent in a growing economy, your best shot at reelection is to just talk about the growing economy. And that's a little bit where Trump is sitting right now. We talked at the outset about coronavirus, and maybe that's going to have an impact on this economy. So I would say that that is something to watch. But for these other candidates, for the Democrats in the race, that's exactly right. They need to come up with this other issue, this insurgent issue, to refocus everyone off of the economy. And I agree, it is not climate change. Not that that's not important or shouldn't be important, but in terms of what voters are telling us they care about, when I look at the data now, I see two interesting things. The first is that among Democrats, the things that are the most important to them are not separating families at the border, not building the wall, not banning Muslims, not banning all abortion. So those are issues that I think are Trump specific. If Donald Trump weren't president, those would not be the priorities. Maybe abortion would still be in there. So that's why so many people say my number one priority is kicking Donald Trump out of the White House.
Mike Madrid, as you, a Republican, look at the Democratic candidates, particularly in California, are you worried about the issues that they are pressing? And do you think that Trump, well, he's obviously in trouble in California. I don't think there's any possibility that he's going to win in this state. But are they setting the stage for a national campaign that could really be damaging to him?
Well, I think that the jury's still kind of out on that. I think there's two different schools of thought. The first is, yeah, if the Democrats continue to consolidate around a candidate who represents, I think, the furthest left of the ideological spectrum, that there's obviously going to be a problem with attracting those middle-of-the-road voters in key states where the Electoral College is going to decide the presidency of the United States. I don't think that that's really debatable. The question becomes is, are there enough lanes in the middle with as many candidates vying for that spot to provide a clear contrast within the Democratic Party to have that discussion? Or are there too many people trying to occupy the not Bernie lane? You know, look, from a policy perspective, I think what we are facing is something unique in American politics. If Bernie Sanders is to win the nomination, I think it's the likeliest scenario at this point. It will be the first time in American history that there will be a populist nominee from both the Republican and Democratic sides of the aisle. We are entering a time where populism is really an insurgent phenomenon that is a social phenomenon. It's not particular to the right or particular to the American left.
Jerry Sirego, are you concerned, as Mike Madrid put it, we have the Democrat who is the furthest left, most likely to be the nominee at this point? And will California, do you think, increase his chances?
It's easy to say, oh, look at Bernie, he's way to the left. he's going to be real trouble for us, which is what a lot of moderates in the party are saying. But I have to tell you, Warren, that the way I assess two things. One, I assess Bernie as having one major advantage, and I think we're seeing that it's bearing fruit, and that is that, forgive the use of the word, he's authentic. I mean, Bernie, unlike some of the other candidates, I'm not going to mention, let's say, Elizabeth Warren by name, is very, very on point all the time. He always has been. He always will be. You know where that guy stands, and he doesn't waver from that. And voters believe very strongly that you better believe what you're telling them. They don't have to agree with you, but if you don't believe what you're telling them, you're dead. So I think he's got that going for him, number one. Number two, and this was just mentioned, if you get away from California and the issues that were talked about here about, you know, Lynn talked about what's important in California, it is important for all of us in the state to remember that between here and New York City, there are tens of millions of Americans who are scared to death about their economic future. You know, we are the economic future, right? This is where it is on the West Coast and in a few other spots. But we're creating jobs and wealth. Every place else is losing jobs and wealth. And those voters, of course, they are susceptible to a populist movement. It would be an interesting match between a leftist populist and a rightist populist. And I am not totally sure how that would come out.
Professor Vavrick, with regard to populism, yes, as we just heard, the candidate of the Democrats, if in fact he's going to be the winner, is consistent, is clear. The populist on the right, who is the president of the United States, it seems to me, is incoherent and often contradictory, perhaps by choice. But does that make a difference? And does that make it more difficult for Democrats, do you think, to define the issues, or does it make it easier?
Well, I think if you asked supporters of the president, they would say he's always clear. Build the wall. Do, you know, all these things that he has constantly campaigned on and continued to talk about throughout his tenure in office. So I don't think that most people who are predisposed to vote for him think that he is inconsistent and unclear. So I also think that Democrats running against him won't think that he's unclear. They will have no problem finding things that he has said to point out things he said repeatedly. So my sense is that on that dimension, both the left and the right will have lots of opportunities to hold these two candidates accountable for their vote histories, the policies that they've tried to advance, and the things that they've said over decades in the public eye. So that is one of the ways that you can imagine a Sanders-Trump race being very different from, say, a Buttigieg-Trump race, a contest in which one side will have to be talking about ideas, not to say that Pete Buttigieg doesn't have a record in South Bend to stand on. He certainly does. But he doesn't have the decades of a past record that Senator Sanders has. So in that sense, just the discourse of those two contests will be very different. And I would encourage voters to think about which kind of conversation they want to have leading up to the November election as they think about which candidates to vote for.
Mike Madrid, our Republican, is the president always clear and understandable?
No, I don't think he is. And I don't think that it matters. And here's why. I think we're all probably universally in agreement that there's this new era of populism is upon us on both the right and the left. But one of the defining characteristics of populism is a lack of ideology. There's a lack of an intellectual or policy underpinnings of both major parties. It's what allows the Republican Party to, in 3 years, suddenly become pro-Russia, pro-tariff, anti-free trade, okay with deficit spending. And yet the leader of the party is the most popular amongst Republicans within the past 20 to 30 years. The reason why is because populism is very closely tied with tribalism. And as long as people are affected by and encouraged by and incited by a cult of personality, their ideology becomes much less malleable. And I see very significant consistencies with Bernie Sanders to this front. Now, Bernie is very different than Donald Trump, as Lynn said correctly. There is a 40-year history of ideological consistency with Bernie Sanders. But what I think is more important in the political construct is both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have extremely loyal followings, oftentimes beyond their ideological underpinnings, if they even have any in Trump's case. And that personality-driven type of politics is a huge characteristic of populism, and it is emergent in our own democracy at this point in time. And I think, it portends the future of the way we talk about politics. So issues are much less relevant than the personalities that are viewed as the leader of your tribe or the protector of your interests.
So, Professor Varick, doesn't that get back then to the question of turnout?
Well, I don't know. I guess I was thinking, I hope I get to ask Mike a question about that. So I'm glad that you've thrown it to me. But I think it's interesting to think about. So is the idea that populism is about personality and that's what's happening right now? Finish the sentence, sort of, how is that affecting our politics at this moment in terms of, is that about the people who are running for office? So more people who are ideologically different within the parties are trying to run for office and are popular among voters? Or is it changing the set of policies that you think are going to end up being negotiated between President and Congress in the next administration?
Well, they make these wild promises, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or whoever else, as if somehow a president, once elected, can in fact institute all these policies that they're talking about. It's as if Congress doesn't exist.
In a time of populism, when there is less ideological underpinnings, which we have historically used, political parties to be a lens through which we view the role of government. In a time of populism, especially when it is emergent on both sides of the political spectrum, what we're dealing with is one of the characteristics, and there are a few of them. One of them is this intense malleability of the ideological underpinnings of the parties, right? And I think I spoke about that a little bit earlier. The way governance works in that environment tends to be much more issue specific based off of what each kind of tribal leader or party chief looks for it to be. So I believe that the times where we have said this is traditionally what Republicans or traditionally what Democrats stand for is going to change dramatically. So, for example, you can have a president, a Republican president, who says, I want to undo all of the free trade agreements that we have been party to, and I want to work with the Democrats to make sure that we're getting fair trade, which is for 40, 50 years has been the lingo of labor unionists and the American left. That is becoming more commonplace. It's been normalized under the Trump administration. I think that's the first of many policy issues that we will be looking at. Our role in the world with NATO, an isolationist policy, a more protectionist policy. These are not traditionally policy objectives affiliated with the American right. And so I think that this is just the beginning of a new era of the way populist governance and a representative democracy is going to operate.
So, Darius Rego, is the Democratic Party malleable ideologically, depending on which candidate gets the nomination?
Oh, there's room for everybody under our broad umbrella. We all know that, and we're seeing that. I'm sitting and I'm listening to this, and several thoughts cross my mind. First of all, if you wanted to design a nomination process that was guaranteed to blow up the party and create divisiveness and confusion and a sense that we're not very competent, then create what we just have gone through, which is a series of debates where you have initially like a dozen people who all wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and see a president who get up on stage and are encouraged to beat each other up. That's not a very effective way to pick a presidential. It's one way, I would argue, it's not very effective. In California, we have 495 delegates, far more than any place. I mean, it's like a fifth of the delegates that you need to win in Milwaukee. We're all obsessed, and this is going off on a tangent we'll get back to, I suspect, with what's happening in four teeny tiny states that amongst them have about 140-some-odd delegates. And so now we look in total disarray, and Bernie's like going to be the next president of the United States or the next nominee based on four battles where there are one-quarter as many delegates as there are, or one-fifth, coming out of California. So, I mean, you have to separate appearances from reality. My concern is, and we're saying this, but we're not saying it this way, look, the country's in deep trouble. We are going through the early stages of a new era of the technological revolution, whatever it is. I mean, you know, I said before, California is gaining population, we're gaining wealth, and much of the country is just shedding population. There are no jobs, there's no future, there's no hope. It's a lot of drugs. And what the Democratic candidates collectively have totally failed to do is to sketch out a vision, hate to use that word, but a vision of what this country needs, what they think this country needs to look like in 2030 or 2040 or pick your out year, and give some sense of how they think they're going to get there. There's no out there. I mean, Biden, who is clearly a vice president and a competent guy, looks like he's walking around in a haze. Bloomberg, who ran the city of New York and apparently did a good job and appears to be a very smart guy, gets up in the first debate and, like a lot of people who have his wealth, looks like, why am I here? I shouldn't have to endure this. I mean, we are just not speaking to the voters about anything that they really care about.
Warren, can I jump in?
Sure. We were just hearing from a Democrat, Derry Srigo. Go ahead.
Well, I want to ask Derry now, if I can. You know this because you advise candidates. And part of the problem, I think, here is that someone like Joe Biden, someone like Bernie Sanders, possibly even others standing on that stage, it's very hard for them to stand up there and say, in 30 years, when I am, you know, talking to my grandchildren, I want to be able to say, I brought you this clean air. You know, you can't make something out of nothing. And those candidates can't say those things because of their age. And so part of the message vacuum on the future. Do you think this is part of it, Derry?
No, I chuckled because you're right. Look, the three top contenders right now, if you leave aside Mayor Pete or ex-Mayor Pete, are all white men in their late 70s, right? Whose first names start with B, coincidentally. and so, you know, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a point well taken that if you look at Joe Biden and you look at, for that matter, Bernie, and you looked at Mayor Bloomberg, and these guys are all older than Trump, by the way, and their collective age, I calculated, I don't know, you add it up, it's like 233 years old. It's a very important point. The person who could be articulating with I think, I don't know if you agree with this, but with credibility, the candidates who could articulate that just based on age and look and feel are all gone except for Buttigieg.
Yeah, and I think you see that in his messaging. I was in Iowa. I went around and heard from most of these people we're talking about, not all of them. But you at the Buttigieg events, and if you've heard his stump speech, there is a lot of this turn the page, a new generation of leadership, the next generation. There's a lot of signaling to the next. And I just think that, you know, every time that Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders says in 10 years, in more than that, that's a moment where people are like, in 10 years.
No, that's great, because what that is dissonant. I mean, that's what you're saying. And voters pick up, as you know, and Mike knows this too, and Warren, you know it. Dissonance is a way to kill yourself. And,
sure.
And it may be that implicitly that dissonance is causing a real problem. I mean, an example of somebody who did it, and I use this in a tape that I've used over the years for media training for candidates, is Bill Clinton's speech, and I guess it was the 96 convention, and we probably all remember it. I forget the number of times. It was like 30 times or 40 times in a whatever it was, 20-minute speech. He used the term, I'm going to build a bridge, we are going to build a bridge to the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lynn, to go back to your point, I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, it has to be evocative. It doesn't have to be terribly specific, right? But it's got, you're right, it's got to be said by somebody who's a credible messenger. And I think that's a very important point.
Well, he was only talking about 4 years, though, at that point. Let me ask you something else about the makeup of the California voting process. You said there are 495 delegates involved, one-fifth of the total. But it seems to me what's most important and what's kept so many of the candidates in running is that in California, it is not winner-take-all.
Well, that gets back to when I was beating up on the debate process. I beat up on this as well.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody's going to sweep California, right? It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. You need 1,991 delegates to win in Milwaukee. We have 495 delegates, right? 416 of those are pledged, 79 are what used to be called superdelegates. Of the 495, I mean, I've got this all in my head, 272 are allocated, of the 416 pledged, 272 are allocated by congressional district, and then you've got 90 at large, and 54 who are elected officials, and it's going to be all over the place.
So the delegates are very different. How do you define a delegate under a situation like that? What does it mean to be one?
You mean after you've gotten through the primary?
Yeah.
Well, depending on what kind of delegate you are, you're pledged on the first vote to whoever it is that you're pledged to.
But only on the first vote. What does that mean?
Oh, I think this whole thing's just going to be, we'll see. We don't know everything that's going to happen. But I mean, my guess, I don't know what Lynn and Mike think, is this has the potential to turn into a brawl in Milwaukee, which, of course, will just affirm to everybody the ability of the Democratic Party to lead this nation. I mean, that may not be the case, but we seem to be headed there.
Once again, we're talking with Democrat Darius Rego in that regard. Mike Madrid, back to you. What if there is a so-called brokered convention? That's what happens when the convention begins in Milwaukee and no candidate has enough votes, 1,990, to actually win. So they begin to dicker around. And as we've just heard, the delegates are only pledged on the first ballot. So if there's more than one ballot, they can move around and change. What can Trump make of that if, in fact, that happens? And would that be to the advantage of the Republicans?
Well, that's a great question. And there is one other thing that does happen. And after the first round of voting in Milwaukee, if no candidate is able to secure that 1,991, which I'm quite confident none of them will be able to, then the superdelegates are released to vote along with the unpledged delegates, which means kind of the establishment, as Bernie Sanders has pointed out, gets to vote. And this is what was so problematic last time with Hillary Clinton and led to kind of the rhetoric about the party process, not just the political capitalist system being rigged, but the Democratic Party system being rigged.
And presumably led a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters not to show up after all and vote, and could well have made a difference in the outcome.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that's the perfect segue to your answer on the Trump piece, which he has already begun the narrative of with as well, which is, you know, they rigged the party system against Bernie last time. They're going to do it again. He seems to, I think, enjoy, as he often does, you know, stoking conflict within the Democratic Party. Again, keep in mind, it's not just that both of these will both be populist candidates if Bernie Sanders is indeed the nomination, but both of them will have come to that place to be the nominee of the party in large part, this is very important, in large part by running against the power structure and the establishment of their own parties. That is a key message that Bernie Sanders has continually beaten the drum on, and it is why he is attracting the attention and the passion of key constituencies within the Democratic coalition that have traditionally been disenfranchised or at least low propensity, low likelihood voters, younger people, Latinos, marginally Democratic people who don't regularly vote or that are being brought into the system, brought into the process. In many ways, that's exactly what Donald Trump was doing, just with more rural white voters who did not have any confidence in the Republican Party. And that running against the leadership of their own parties is central to the rise of both of these political figures. So Trump, you can expect him to play into that more and more, undermining the Democratic Party with these calls for corruption or these pronouncements about how the system is rigged, how they're doing it to Bernie again. What that does is it emboldens Bernie's base. It makes them even more dug in because, as I mentioned earlier, they become more reliant on the personality, not the process. Most of these people that are Bernie supporters believe much more in Bernie Sanders than they do the Democratic Party. The same thing with Trump, incidentally. And so as a result, it becomes a battle between these two personalities, both of which are running against not just this generic swamp in Trump's case or the establishment in Bernie's case, but really against their own party structures.
Let me ask all three of you before we close. Final comment. Lynn Vavreck, you first, political scientist, UCLA.
That's a wildly broad question. I guess I think that the last comment I would want to make about this whole process is that I think it is important that people go out and interact with these candidates if they can. So the process of seeing them up close and not just on their television, I think can be revealing to people in terms of things like a candidate's ability to do the job, to interact with people, things that you're not seeing in paid political messaging. So if you can, go online, figure out where the candidates are, and go try to see one of them.
Darius Rego, that possible between now and Tuesday?
Pretty tough. I mean, to go back to something that Lynn was talking about, and I think all three of us would agree on this. Look, I think we have tremendous respect for voters. The problem is, in general, and certainly in California in particular, that they have to make decisions that they take very seriously based on next to no data. I mean, if anybody can tell me anything about a judicial candidate, please raise your hand. And you don't get exposed to candidates in person. You don't get exposed to candidates very much in media. We no longer have central media, you know, just a few newspapers, few television stations. People get their information from all over the place. So it is a very discombobulated process. And the last people we ought to blame for that are the voters.
So Mark Madrid, Darius Rego thinks it's very difficult to do what Professor Vavrick says people ought to do. What do you think?
Well, I think they're both right. It would give a political statement. I think the important final point here is that California matters for the first time in a very long time. I think that the way our state votes will actually be determinative in who the Democratic nominee is going to be. So if you do have that opportunity, that scarce opportunity as a voter to go meet a candidate, by all means, please do that. If you don't, spend the time, effort, and energy, because the voting power of a Californian is much greater in this election cycle than in any other state. And I think that as diverse as we are, geographically, racially, ethnically, by class, by gender, what comes out of this petri dish called California is likely going to guide and direct the future of the country for the first time in a very, very long time. So take it seriously.
Lynn Vavrick of UCLA, Mike Madrid with the Republican strategist group Grassroots Lab in Sacramento, Darius Rego, a Democratic consultant, also editor and publisher of the Target Book. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break, then we'll come back with a very interesting account of how the fossil fuel industry turned propaganda into public relations. The goal was to manipulate the news media and confuse the public. It's all about climate change. Back in a moment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
All right, I'll be back with To the Point. Global warming caused by human activity is a partisan issue in the United States, with President Donald Trump, of course, denying many conclusions of climate science that are accepted by Democrats. But it wasn't always that way. Here's another Republican president, George H.W. Bush, 30 years ago.
We all know that human activities are changing the atmosphere in unexpected and in unprecedented ways.
That was then. This is now. Amy Westerfeld is a climate journalist. She currently hosts the podcast Drilled about the creation and spread of climate denial. Great to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So here's George W. Bush in 1990 making it sound as if he was concerned about climate change.
Yeah, he was concerned. I mean, that's the kind of interesting thing is that it was a bipartisan issue in the late 80s and early 90s, and there was a pretty deliberate attempt to shift it into a sort of politicized issue.
Let's talk about how it was bipartisan. A lot of people have been talking about how we have known about this, and the oil companies have known about it for decades. George H.W. Bush knew about it. So what were people saying in addition to him in 1990? What do they want to do?
Yeah, 1990 is actually a really interesting year because that is when not just the politicians, but the media were really starting to kind of cotton on to this idea that this was happening and it was serious and something needed to shift. You had, you know, big cover stories about global warming and all these things that kind of, you know, things that we're seeing now, too. So it's interesting to look at. But they were saying that, you know, we needed to curb greenhouse gas emissions. And the conservatives in particular were kind of taking the tack that, you know, American innovation could solve this problem. I think in that same speech that you just played a clip from, George H.W. Bush said, you know, the greenhouse effect hasn't met the White House effect. And they had this whole kind of thing of, you know, we can solve this. It's a science and engineering problem and we're going to do it. And then you have the Rio Earth Summit happening in 1992. And going into that, George H.W. Bush was kind of talking about all of these policy ideas for doing something about greenhouse gas emissions. And we're not exactly sure what happened, but suddenly at that, in sort of the run-up to that event, he backpedaled massively and said, you know, well, started to kind of trot out the line of, you know, we can't let this impact the American economy, and any changes that we make need to be considered in the context of, you know, continued economic growth in the U.S. and all these kinds of things. And you start to sort of see this unraveling of progress there.
Well, one of the ways, obviously, that this has changed has to do with what's referred to now broadly as disinformation. Where'd it come from?
It actually started, you know, I've done a lot of research for the most recent season of Drilled, looking into sort of the history of the fossil fuel industry's propaganda efforts, and was surprised to find that disinformation was something that they were doing more than 100 years ago. So the very, very first publicist was a guy named Ivy Ledbetter Lee, and he worked for Standard Oil and the Rockefeller family. And he was initially contracted to help them deal with the fallout from the Ludlow Massacre, which was a big coal miners' strike at one of the Rockefeller mines in 1914 in Colorado. And Rockefeller's kind of, you know, gave the go-ahead to their security forces to, you know, crush this strike by any means necessary. And armed guards kind of stormed this protest camp and started lighting tents on fire and shooting into the crowd. And at the end of it, there were several people dead, including women and children who had been in the camp, which sparked some pretty bad press for the Rockefellers. So they bring in this guy, Ivy Lee, and he creates this whole fabricated story. So he first off starts saying that the protesters weren't really miners, that they were just part of the union, and that some of them were hired actors. So we have the first kind of, you know, example of the crisis actor story way back then. And then he claimed that the whole thing was concocted by Mother Jones. Somehow he added in the fact that she was running a brothel at the time, which is hilarious because I think Mother Jones was maybe 82 or 83 at that point. So not happening. But anyway, so he created this whole fake story that kind of did this thing that the oil companies have become really expert at now, which is sort of wrapping a few facts in lies so that, you know, you could point to the sort of factual things as, look, see, we're telling you guys the truth. We're being transparent. And then kind of sell this other story along with it. So disinformation is kind of part of their DNA. I mean, that was only a couple decades after the industry had started that they were starting to do it, and it's only gotten more refined and sophisticated since then.
Was this just public relations, or was it picked up as news as well?
Oh, it was picked up as news. Ivy Lee actually created the first press release on behalf of railroad companies at the time. And, you know, of course, also did this for Standard Oil, too. And because newspapers were so not used to getting press releases or even really getting companies to tell them anything, it was sort of an adversarial relationship, they were so surprised to get these things that they just printed them in full in the newspaper. So it was kind of an amazing thing and lent quite a bit of credibility and power to the PR folks that were working on behalf of industry in those early years. You know, eventually newspapers sort of caught up and figured out that, hey, these guys are just trying to sell a story here. But for the first, you know, 5 to 10 years, yeah, they would just print it outright. In fact, so much so that when we looked into the archive of Ivy Lee's papers, there were multiple examples of press releases that he had sent with a handwritten note that explained to reporters and editors, hey, this is just for your information. Like, don't print this, you know?
And they printed it anyway.
In some cases, yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, we use terms like propaganda, we use terms like public relations, and the relationship between the two is very interesting. And here is a soundbite we have from another gentleman, Edward Bernays, who was a nephew of Sigmund Freud. This was recorded in the 1960s. It's a little difficult to understand, but it's worth listening to. It's not very long. And listen to for the words propaganda and public relations.
I decided that if you could use propaganda for war, you could certainly use it for peace. And propaganda got to be a bad word because of the Germans using it. So what I did was to try to find some other words. So we found the word Council on Public Relations.
Public relations, another word for propaganda. How interesting. How important was Edward Bernays?
Bernays is very important. So he was a sort of a compatriot of Ivy Lee's. They worked together during World War I when Bernays was working on the Creel Commission, which was sort of the U.S. government's war propaganda arm, selling the U.S. on the necessity of World War I and selling the rest of the world on America as the sort of warrior for democracy all over the world. So he worked as part of that commission, and then after the war, as you heard there, went home and thought, you know, hey, this stuff really works, but people are starting to think propaganda is sort of a negative thing, so I need to come up with a new term for it. And that's how we got the phrase public relations. So there's literally no difference between the two.
Did Bernays work for the oil companies?
He did a bit. So he actually inherited Standard Oil and the Rockefellers as a client after Ivy Lee died. Ivy Lee considered Bernays sort of the only other publicity professional that was kind of his equal. So he encouraged his clients to work with Bernays. And he also worked with General Motors and the American Tobacco Company, and various other kind of big American companies. And his sort of specialty was really psychological manipulation at a massive scale. So there's this great quote about him that he was a bit of a, I don't know, he was a bit sort of socially awkward one-on-one because he thought about people in terms of thousands and not individuals. He was kind of always thinking about what drove groups of people.
So how do you get the term psychological manipulation into this?
So he, because he was Freud's nephew, he grew up really kind of learning all about psychology and psychoanalysis and repression and taboos and all of these things kind of as dinner table conversation. And he also helped to translate all of his uncle's books into English. So he was quite familiar with psychoanalytic theory and sort of this idea of these kind of just under the surface drives that would, kind of shape people's behavior. And so he carried that into his work and would often consult psychoanalysts about, you know, what kind of psychological connections there were to different products and how to use that.
Well, bring us forward now to the current day, if you will. First, we had tobacco. Now we have oil using psychological manipulation as taught to them by Edward Bernays and others. How does it work, and how important is it to the general public's perception of A, tobacco, B, oil?
It's very important. So there's this really interesting thing that's happened where because oil companies in large part kind of borrowed the whole concept of science denial from the tobacco industry. There's been a little bit of a misunderstanding of the history there and a thinking that, oh, you know, tobacco came up with everything and then oil copied them. But what we've found in sort of digging into the historical records, especially on these public relations guys, is that they were influencing each other a lot from early on and like up until, you know, the 80s. And they would share information back and forth about sort of what worked and what didn't. And they all kind of used these various strategies. So they would kind of focus on their industry as really important to the American economy and often the American identity. They both used the strategy of kind of getting people while they're young.
Esso helps your car stay young.
There's actually some documentation of tobacco industry executives and oil industry executives being in the same room together talking about this idea that you have to reach very, very young people, ideally around the age of 4 or 5, because that's when their notions of how the world works are being shaped. And in the case of the oil companies, their big push was to convince people that a carbon-based economy was as immutable a fact as physics, which I think is so interesting when you look at the sort of discourse on climate change today, because you hear that constantly, even from people who think it's very important to act and to act, you know, swiftly on climate. They will often say something about how, you know, we don't want to disrupt the oil and gas industry overly much, or, you know, we just don't know how society will work at all without carbon-based fuels. It's this kind of very ingrained idea that has made it hard for people to imagine a world without oil. On the tobacco side, you know, they sort of wanted to just get the idea of tobacco as safe and cool into people's heads as early as possible. And then also, you know, Bernays did a bunch of work to break down the taboo against women smoking, which was a huge coup for the tobacco industry. So, you know, they were missing out on half the population as customers because there was a big taboo against women smoking in public. And Bernays sort of looked at it and thought, well, you know, there's kind of a burgeoning women's rights movement in the 20s here, and I think I can tap into that and sell the idea of cigarettes as kind of liberating for women and, you know, breaking this taboo as them fighting back and whatever. So he rebranded cigarettes as torches of freedom for women. And staged a whole kind of fake protest and then let the newspapers know about it. And I mean, it was within a few months, it had totally shifted and it was completely fine for women to smoke. And tobacco companies had, you know, doubled their customer base.
And lest anybody think this wasn't intentional or that it wasn't done in order to sell a product, here again is another quote from the voice of Edward Bernays.
One day, Mr. George Hill, president of the American Tobacco Company, called me in and said, we're losing half of our market. And I said, why, Mr. Hill? He said, there's a taboo by men that does not permit women to smoke. What can we do about breaking down that taboo?
So, Amy Westerfeld, they found out what to do.
Yeah, they sure did. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that has been most interesting to me, and I think is kind of important for people to realize, is just how much thought and intentional strategy has gone into not just, you know, trying to shape policy and things like that, but to really shift society and to genuinely manipulate people and how they think about things. Like the cigarette example is really interesting to me because a bunch of women kind of bought this whole thing too, you know? And so you had thousands of women thinking, I'm smoking, therefore I'm liberated, when in reality it was just some guy trying to sell them cigarettes, you know?
But there they were, and they were part of advertising, and as you indicated, it was looking cool and glamorous and You know, how do you hold it? How do you move it around? Where do you blow the smoke?
Yeah. Yeah, the cigarette companies actually started doing classes to teach women how to smoke.
Wow. I didn't know about that part.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about the news business. You indicated that initially when Standard Oil was handing out false information about the strike that had occurred in Colorado, the news media simply printed it as if it were news, and they didn't label it or do anything of the kind. To what extent have the news media bought into these other campaigns?
You know, there's been a real history of these campaigns being kind of one step ahead of the media for a long time. But then in the last 10 years or so, I think it's fair to say that the media is kind of caught up and is aware of all of these tactics. And I think it's really kind of time for media to rethink how they deal with these industries, given how much is now known about the ways that they try to shape, you know, policy and people's ideas and everything like that. Because there's still kind of this thing happening where, you know, media feel compelled to, you know, give, you know, oil company CEOs their say, for example, or in a lot of cases, I just wrote a story about this for The Nation. There are several major outlets that are making ad campaigns for oil companies through their sort of internal brand studios. And that just seems like a bridge too far to me, you know, especially when you look at the fact that these companies' ads are not selling a product. You know, gas is a commodity. No one is like, oh, I only use mobile gas, you know? So they're selling ideas and they're selling the public on the notion that they are good faith actors. And, you know, they intentionally work with these outlets because it gives them a boost of credibility. When they have these campaigns come out, for example, the New York Times does this through the Times brand studio. And when, you know, Exxon or Chevron do these ads with them, they will always do a bunch of social media around it and tag the New York Times brand studio in them. That's the only time that they ever mention who made the ad. And, you know, and it's because they like the sort of whiff of credibility that the New York Times brand gives them. And, you know, especially with the Times, the oil industry has been kind of trying to get a boost off of the Times reputation for years. You know, Mobil Oil invented the advertorial working with the New York Times and tracked fairly frequently how much that was benefiting them in terms of people's perceptions of them, and found that, you know, it helped people to think of them as legitimate and smart and sort of the thinking man's oil company. And, you know, it's kind of like it's been going on for a long time. And now you have The Guardian saying we're not going to take fossil fuel ads at all. And you've got the New York Times and the Washington Post actually making these companies ads for them. So there's this really broad spectrum of how the media is dealing with all of this stuff. But I think in general, it's sort of we're overdue for an ethics conversation. Because when I talked, I asked, you know, the Times and the Washington Post and, you know, NPR does some of these ads too, about their decision-making process. And they always sort of fall back on either the idea that there's a firewall between advertising and editorial, or that nothing they're doing is illegal. And I kind of feel like it's not illegal is not an adequate ethics policy in an age of disinformation.
So let's just go through this step by step here. On the one hand, we talk about false equivalence, and you mentioned having the oil company head on the story about oil to say that it's really not destroying the atmosphere or ruining the climate. That's one thing. And there seems now to finally be a willingness to back away from false equivalence, although you still do hear it and see it in news reporting, don't you? Especially on TV.
You do. You know, TV has been very slow on that. Print has kind of gotten rid of it for the most part. It's not as bad as it used to be, for sure. But the cable news guys, man, I mean, it took them, I think I think that you're starting to see a little bit of a shift, in part because Chuck Todd got so blasted for doing, he did a Meet the Press kind of climate episode in 2018, where he had on a spokesperson from the American Enterprise Institute, who was kind of like, you know, I'm not a scientist, but it seems to me like blah, 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 you know? And now I think this past year, his climate episode, you know, was not including kind of known science denier think tanks, at least. So that's progress. But yeah, it still kind of happens. And actually, false equivalence is something that the oil industry PR guys came up with. So there was a guy who worked for Mobil Oil named Herb Schmertz way back in the 80s, 70s and 80s. And he really kind of pioneered the idea that if you didn't like how reporters were covering your company, if you kind of criticized them for either being inaccurate or being unfair, that they would overcorrect in your favor. And it worked like a charm. We actually found some old tape of him describing this strategy in a an interview with, I think it was Mike Wallace. But anyway, yeah, he talks about how, well, I was trying to, you know, push them to cover Mobil's point of view. And we figured out that a good way to do that was to accuse them of bias or inaccuracy, because journalists don't like that.
The problem being that Mobil's point of view, we now know, was essentially a lie.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Especially starting in the late 80s and early 90s, and then, you know, once they were acquired and merged with Exxon, there's heavy, I think, out of all the companies, there's probably more documentation on Exxon doing a copious amount of research into climate change, and then subsequently, you know, having their CEO say things like the science is inconclusive, you know. So yeah, it's not great.
Okay, well, that's on the news side. Let's talk a little bit more about what's on the other side of the so-called firewall. And you have discovered that the New York Times, the Washington Post, and even, you say, NPR, does in fact manufacture what are nothing more than bits of propaganda, whatever you choose to call it, public relations, for big oil?
So NPR doesn't necessarily manufacture them. I mean, you know, NPR has their own people voice every ad, but they don't really like create the campaigns, although they do run quite a few fossil fuel ads in their podcasts. But the Washington Post and the New York Times, yes.
So more in the podcast, not on the news program so much as in the podcast.
Right, because they're not allowed to in the news programs. So this is a really interesting thing. I don't know if people have noticed that they're hearing more fossil fuel ads in podcasts. But the big reason for that is that the claims that they make in these ads would not pass muster on broadcast radio. So they have, you know, just in the same way that fossil fuel companies have really glommed onto social media, which also doesn't have any real rules around what they can say, Right. They are really into podcasts because they can kind of get away with making outlandish claims. Like there's a there's one that Exxon was running where it claimed that carbon capture could potentially capture 90% of emissions from power plants, which is kind of wildly out of step with what the science says carbon capture is going to be able to do anytime soon. So,
well, at least they said potentially. They didn't say it's happening now.
Yes, the word potentially is doing a lot of work in that ad.
Right. Well, now what? Back to the New York Times and the Washington Post. Yeah, what are they doing?
So they have these internal brand studios, and they are making these kind of massive wraparound campaigns for various oil companies that will include articles and videos and social media ads, all kinds of things where they help to create the content. And they sell this on the brand studio websites as, you know, put the New York Times to work for you kind of thing. You know, it's like, we know how to influence the influential. So they're very much leveraging the reputations of these newsrooms to sell companies on the branded content side of things. But then they very quickly will rush to say, you know, oh, but there's a line between ad and edit when questioned about this stuff. And it's like, well, okay, but you're selling the credibility of the newspaper as a major reason that these companies should ask you guys instead of like an advertising agency to come up with these things, right? So you can't really have it both ways. And I would say too that, okay, yes, I think there is a firewall between ad and edit. I don't actually think that New York Times and Washington Post reporters are being unduly influenced by these ad buys. However, I do think that their readers are being influenced. And I think that because I've seen oil company reports on how these campaigns are working for them. So I just think that there needs to be some accountability there and some thinking through, you know, what that actually does to the quality of the news that people are consuming. And then the other one also is Vox. So they've produced an entire podcast for the American Enterprise Institute, which is sort of a known dark money funded think tank that often pushes climate denial. And, you know, it was put out as just sort of like another Vox podcast. And there's a little bit of like, if you listen to the show, the guy eventually says that he's the head of the American Enterprise Institute, but there's no real explanation of what that is or what they do. And it's sort of, it kind of surprises me that, that they did it, especially given that Vox does such a great job covering climate change. So anyway, yeah. And, you know, the argument is always kind of like, well, we don't want to, you know, shut down other viewpoints or be biased towards one thing or another. But I just think like if one of those viewpoints is heavily funded by an industry that's trying to protect its profits, is that really a viewpoint that everybody needs to hear? I don't know.
The whole idea of disinformation, it seems to me, is a kind of undermining of truth. And it seems to me that when the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Vox allow their most precious asset, which is their credibility and their reputation for being straight and accurate, to be used in this way, it does lead to people, I would think, when they find out about it, to wonder, when are they getting the truth? And are they ever getting the truth?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it does. I don't know. I've talked to some New York Times reporters about this, and, you know, some will totally defend the, the company's right to do this and need to do this, especially given that it is hard out there for news companies on the financial front.
Very hard. They're going out of business. McClatchy is going bankrupt.
Yeah, exactly. And no one wants to see less money for news organizations. So it's a tough situation. But I've also talked to reporters who feel like it erodes their credibility and it undermines their work. And I don't think they're wrong either. So it's a tough conversation, but one that I think we need to be having.
Would it be possible to ban advertising? I suppose if you were working with the oil issue and with global warming, you'd have to ban ads for cars and airlines and travels and cruises down the Mississippi River.
Right. I know. So that actually came up with the Guardian's policy. And we talked to their interim CEO. And she said something that I thought was really interesting, which was that for them, there's a sort of qualitative difference between the fossil fuel ads and these other categories because, again, the fossil fuel companies are not advertising a product. They're doing sort of corporate reputation ads or issue ads, which is different from, you know, selling gas or selling a car or selling a flight to Hawaii. So that's kind of how they have dealt with that question, which I thought was pretty interesting. But yeah, it's kind of a slippery slope, you know. And I also think that there is a little bit of a missed opportunity there if you kind of ban them outright to just educate the public a little bit around this stuff. So, you know, for example, with the NPR stuff, those podcasts in particular, because they're generally considered, you know, just straight information and science and whatnot. I think, you know, if there's a sort of misleading ad, that hosts could come out of that ad explaining, you know, what's sort of misleading about it. And probably the companies would pull their ads after that anyway, but you'd be able to educate people a bit in the meantime.
When the oil companies get the New York Times, the Washington Post to produce their advertising and then make a point of it on social media and sort of steal the credibility of the newspapers and the news value of them, that is designed, it seems to me, in part to affect people who are thought to be influentials and people who help other people learn how to think. What happens when BlackRock and Larry Fink begin to talk about the economic viability of the oil companies?
I think that it's really an interesting moment. So you had the Larry Fink letter, and then you had Jim Cramer, you know, a few days after, I think, was it? I can't remember if it was before or after that, but saying, you know, I'm done with fossil fuels. Divestment is picking up steam worldwide. And people, I thought it was actually really interesting when Jim Cramer came out with this, because what he said was like, people don't care about the performance of these stocks. These companies are actually performing well, if all you care about is profit, but people are dumping these stocks anyway. And that is an indication to me that fossil fuels are done and, you know, they're the new tobacco. Like, I'm done with them.
These stocks don't want to be owned by younger people. Their dividends are great. These companies are doing better than obviously when oil was at 26, 27. But you can tell that the world's turned on them. It's actually kind of happening very quickly. You're seeing divestiture by a lot of different funds. It's going to be a parade. Look, these are tobacco, and we're not going to own them.
Yeah, Jim Cramer on CNBC, who has a big audience. But tell our listeners a little bit more about Larry Fink and his letter.
Yeah. So Larry Fink sent this letter. He sends a letter out annually to the kind of the investment community and to BlackRock shareholders and all that kind of stuff.
And BlackRock is the biggest investment house in the world, I believe, with many trillions of assets.
So he sends out this annual letter where he kind of gives people the lay of the land and talks about his focus for the year ahead and those kinds of things. And he said that he would not be investing in companies that didn't have or that had an uncertain sustainability. So specifically that, you know, oil and gas companies were just not looking like good investments right now. However, he's still personally invested in oil and gas companies. So that's a little bit weird, but
at least for the moment.
Yeah, at least for the moment. But I do think it's a big kind of signal to people. There was also just in the last couple of weeks, there was this JP Morgan shareholder report, too, that kind of said, yeah, climate change is a really big issue. Their report was a little fuzzy on what exactly they were going to do about it. But I don't know. I feel like the fact that you're seeing kind of big players, people with big audiences in the financial community saying this is a bad investment, this is an uncertain investment, and you know, not one that we think is going to pay off in the end, is very, very interesting, because traditionally those folks have steered away from, you know, especially being negative about stocks that do pay dividends. So that's been a really interesting thing to see, and I think that we can kind of credit the fossil fuel divestment movement with that. The activists that have been working on divestment for a long time have really started to gain some traction in the last 5 or so years, with getting both universities and pension funds and various other investment funds to drop oil and gas from their portfolios.
On the other hand, if Larry Fink still holds oil and gas stocks, how is this different from the situation, the disinformation issue, when the oil company tells you we're really doing all we can to deal with climate change, when in fact, obviously, they aren't, despite what they say?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's first of all, it'll be interesting to see whether and how BlackRock pulls out from those stocks. So I think Fink personally owns stock in some of those companies, but and he hasn't said whether he personally will divest or not. So we'll see what happens with BlackRock. But then I do also think there's a slight difference there in that even if Larry Fink doesn't back up what he says with his own actions, it's still a big signal to the market that he's willing to publicly say these are not a good investment. So I do think there's a slight difference there. I mean, it's lame that he's also, you know, profiting from these things that he's saying are not a good investment. But I do think that his... Yeah, his letter kind of carries some amount of weight with other investors.
Very quickly, as we come to an end of our podcast, with regard to the New York Times, The Washington Post, Vox, and others, you've done some work for us. We haven't attempted to get those people on our podcast to talk about it because you've already tried.
I have tried. Yeah. Both the New York Times and the Washington Post turned down interviews, but said, you know, sent a sort of official, you know, there's a firewall between advertising and editorial and we're not doing anything illegal kind of thing. I also actually reached out to the Washington Post, like through my podcast company, to get details about their advertising. So I said, you know, I'm interested in advertising my podcast. How does it work? And, you know, how do these things work with the brand studio? How much is that? And the advertising salesperson told me, oh yeah, I mean, if you want to do brand studio stuff, you know, you're looking at sort of six figures minimum. And then if you want video too, that's more. And so these are definitely big, you know, big accounts for these media outlets. It's not like, you know, The Guardian banned these ads, but they were not doing this whole brand studio thing and they were not really running that many fossil fuel ads to begin with. So you know, it was about 1% of their overall advertising revenue, which isn't nothing, but it'd be a much bigger hit to The Washington Post or The New York Times to stop doing these branded campaigns. Yeah. And then Vox, I have sent, I think, 12 requests to various people and not gotten an answer from anyone. So they don't want to talk about it. But, you know, the podcast is out there. So it's hard to deny that they did it.
All right. Well, we're talking to another podcaster, Amy Westerfeld, and her podcast is Drilled. She is a climate journalist as well as a podcaster. We heard her refer to one of her recent articles, and she's had many others in many different places. It's great to talk with you. Look forward to doing it again, one podcaster to another. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Have a good rest of your day.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer's Chuck Previtari. You can find our previous episodes on your favorite podcasting app. And you can reach out to us on Twitter. We're at @ToThePoint_KCRW. You can tweet me at @WarrenOlney1. We want to know what you think and what you'd like to hear. We really want to know that. Come back again.